Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Here's a trivia question. What do all of the following songs have in common? Take the last train to Clarksville and I'll meet you at the station. You can be here by 4:30 because I've made your reservation. Don't be slow. Hey, Mr. Tambourine, play a song for me. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the if you said they're all classic pop hits likely to be found on any iPod worth its salt, you're right, but that's not the answer we were looking for. Actually, each song features instrumental work by a prodigious group of largely anonymous Los Angeles studio musicians, who dominated the charts in the 60s and early 70s and came to be known as the Wrecking Crew. When popular bands and star producers like Phil Spector and Sonny Bono needed a hit, they turned to the Wrecking Crew for backup. Reliable and professional, but also creative and experimental, the studio musicians helped solidify the sound of an era, even though they rarely played live, with only a handful of members going on to solo fame. Author Kent Hartman covers the long reign of LA's studio kings and queens in The Wrecking Crew, the inside story of rock and roll's best-kept secret. Hartman told me that for most studio musicians, The Wrecking Crew was a perfect gig.
The Wrecking Crew was, you know, roughly a couple of dozen rock and roll session musicians in L.A. in the 60s who, played on hundreds of famous hits without anybody knowing it. And none of the people are known to the public except for a couple of them. The two that broke out of the Wrecking Crew and became stars on their own later were Glenn Campbell and Leon Russell.
What made the rise of the Wrecking Crew? Was it the style change in American taste? Was it rock music rising that sort of gave all these people employment?
Yeah, rock and roll really started to hit its stride in the early 60s. And Phil Spector, the producer Phil Spector, was at the forefront of that. And in Hollywood, in L.A., he was recording what we have come to know as his wall of sound on all those great Ronettes and Crystals and the Righteous Brothers hits. And anyway, he was the first to start using these session musicians on all those hits, and then they slowly became known as the Wrecking Crew, and then every other producer in town wanted to use them too.
One of the things you point out in the book that's very interesting is that these people got little to no credit. You know, they weren't on album sleeves, they weren't getting talked about on radio. As you talk to them now in writing this book, are they at all bitter about that?
No, not at all. They were paid really well back in the day. So when the Wrecking Crew would come in and play the instruments in place of, you know, the Beach Boys and the Association and the Grassroots and Gary Puckett and the Union Gap and just on and on and on, they were paid very well to do that. And no, they didn't get credited for it because the record labels didn't want us, the public, to know at all that our favorite bands were being replaced by these session people. But the Wrecking Crew got paid well, and it was really steady employment, and they were quite happy to do it. So no, there are no bitter feelings today.
You know, an interesting part of the book is the older generation trying to capitalize on the Wrecking Crew, including people like Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra. What was unique about their sound or the way they played that allowed that to work for other artists?
Well, the interesting thing about the Wrecking Crew is, at least to me, is that they were, I don't know if you ever, have you ever seen that movie Zelig with Woody Allen?
In fact, I just watched it this year.
Well, that movie, you know, he was known as Leonard Zelig, the human chameleon. And that's how I think of the Wrecking Crew, because they were so good at doing what they did that they could come in, and whether it was for, like I mentioned earlier, the Association or Simon and Garfunkel or the Mamas and the Papas, or it could be Frank Sinatra or Dean Martin, they would come in and they could sound as they needed to sound for those bands. And so they were musical chameleons.
Set the stage, if you can, for what exactly the landscape was like in the music industry, because it seems, reading your book, that today we talk a lot about single-song downloads and that kind of thing, but even more so in the 60s, you needed a hit record. I mean, literally week to week, you needed a hit record.
Yes, it's funny. Today, with downloads, we've come full circle, and now it's back to the individual song as opposed to an album. And then, but of course, during the 70s and 80s, albums were what mattered. But back in the 60s, when the Wrecking Crew hit it big, doing what they did in place of all these famous bands, it was the hit single that mattered, because 45 RPM records were what mattered back then. And so getting on the top 40 pop charts was everything. And so that's why they were brought in, because the Wrecking Crew were the best of the best. They could come in and play better and faster and more error-free than anybody else. And then they also knew how to add extra little, you know, I call them flavoring agents to the songs, where they could take something that was ordinary and turn it into a hit.
And this didn't always happen. There were a lot of people in the scene who were happy to get a paycheck. But what happened when band members felt like their positions were being usurped by the Wrecking Crew in those situations?
Most of the time, the band members themselves that were being replaced were okay with it. They were cool. I mentioned a story about the drummer from the Byrds having a four-letter word shouting match in the studio with the producer over being replaced by the drummer in the Wrecking Crew. Because, you know, Mr. Tambourine Man, it's all the Wrecking Crew on that song except for Roger McGuinn from the Byrds. He is playing his 12-string guitar on it, but the producer felt that the Byrds, for example, were incompetent on their own instruments, and so he used the Wrecking Crew, and sure enough, the song went right to number one. But other bands I talk about, like Gary Puckett and the Union Gap, and also the Grassroots, they each had a band member that wasn't very happy about being replaced, and they reacted to it in different ways. But most of the time, the bands were cool, because they knew that, hey, we still get to sing on these songs, and we do play them in concert, and we get most of the money, and we get all the girls.
Well, that's a persuasive argument. tell me about that drummer, Hal Blaine. It's hard to imagine he slept at all during these couple decades.
Yeah, and you're right about that, maybe more than you know, because there were nights where, or some days where Hal was in the studio with the Wrecking Crew, and Hal being in such demand, he played on 40 number one hits alone. But there were nights where he was in the studio and the session would end at 2 or 3 in the morning, and in the same studio he would have an 8 a.m. call, and so there was just no point in even going back home, so he would lay down on the floor next to his drum kit and sleep.
What was it that broke this crew up?
In the early 70s, music was changing. Being more authentic, having bands play their own instruments, you know, groups like the Eagles and Chicago and the Doobie Brothers, people like that, excellent musicians, they insisted upon playing their own instruments, and they were very good musicians. And so that started to spell the demise for the Wrecking Crew. They weren't needed as much. Also, underground FM radio had come along and was slowly replacing top 40 AM radio. So the real reliance on these three-minute peppy hits that the Wrecking Crew could punch out, there wasn't as big of a reliance on that anymore either.
So at the beginning, I asked you about who some of these members were, and notably, I mean, maybe 40 people were considered members of the Wrecking Crew. Not that many had substantial solo careers, recording careers. So it's interesting. I want to ask about maybe Glenn Campbell in specific. Here's a guy you trace from childhood. He had nothing, and he saw that LA was a place to hone his skills, and he could be a backing musician and maybe go on the road with the Beach Boys, and eventually he would have a solo career. But was the Wrecking Crew a place to advance your career, or was that the end of your ambition if you really were a talented sideman?
Well, for most in the Wrecking Crew, it was where they wanted to be. Once they got there, they were making excellent money, and they were in demand like every day of the week. They were happy to do it. They didn't dream of being out on the road themselves or being a headliner. But Glenn Campbell was different. He always had that ambition. And unlike maybe the rest of the Wrecking Crew, he also was an excellent singer. And so he was cutting demos on the side for Capitol Records the whole time, hoping that one of them would catch the ear of, you know, a radio station who would play it and so forth. And then finally that did happen for him. In 1967, he had his first big hit, which was By the Time I Get to Phoenix. And of course, who did he hire to play on that? He hired all of his pals in the Wrecking Crew.
Has there been any sort of reunion time when these members have gotten back together?
No. Once they sort of started to scatter in the early to mid-70s, they haven't really gotten back together on any songs to speak of, except in 1992, Phil Spector decided to try to resurrect the old days, and he had a song in mind, and he brought in, oh gosh, maybe 15 different people from the Wrecking Crew and brought them all into a studio in L.A. and tried to cut a song that day, and it just didn't work out because the technology in the studio had advanced, and he didn't really like how it worked, and so he scrapped the session, and that was the last time they ever got together.
So we know now that the Wrecking Crew deserves a lot of credit for the sound of so many hits that we all love, but I wonder, does it detract at all from some of the legendary names who recorded with them, knowing now that, hey, that wasn't, you know, so-and-so on the guitar, or that wasn't a guitar solo that was really by this band? I mean, do you think that, in a way, this sort of undercuts that sound?
Well, I don't know. I think maybe today, you know, we as the listening public are maybe, I hate to say it, but maybe a little more cynical, and so we're not so wide-eyed and innocent as we might have been back in the 60s. So knowing that these session musicians played on a whole lot of this stuff, I don't know. To me, it's not such a damning thing as it would have been back in the 60s. You know, the record labels then were paranoid. They didn't want anybody to know any of this, because if people found out, for example, that the Beach Boys didn't play the instruments on almost all their hits, that would have freaked the public out back then. In fact, here's something interesting. You know, the Beatles recorded Sgt. Pepper's in 67 as a direct response to the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds album, which is, you know, considered a legendary album. But I'll guarantee you that Paul McCartney and the other Beatles had no idea that when they listened to Pet Sounds back then, that there wasn't a Beach Boy on it.
And you sort of trace this depressing moment for Brian Wilson where he's made his magnum opus and the public doesn't buy it. And he retreats into depression, and the Wrecking Crew is over at his house, and he's heavy and he's shadowy all of a sudden. It's almost as if the fun-loving Beach Boys surf sound was much more palatable than something of artistic value, even though this is the same public, as you say, that went on to have a great love affair with the Beatles and the Stones and some of the more experimental music.
Yeah, I think maybe the public, the reason Pet Sounds didn't sell well originally was because it was such a departure, as you say, from the regular surf and car and girl kind of songs that the Beach Boys were known for. And I think today that's still what people think of with the Beach Boys is, you know, that happy California sound that they had. And so by the time Pet Sounds came out, which was groundbreaking, but the public didn't buy it, it took years for it to even go gold. And though it was a big influence, like I mentioned, on the Beatles, and then that really sent Brian Wilson into a tailspin. You know, when the public didn't love his album the way he loved it, you know, then he tried to do that Smile album after that, and he used the Wrecking Crew on that, like you're mentioning, up at his house, at his studio. But by then, Brian was, you know, he was taking drugs, he was eating a lot, and he was hiding from everybody, and it was just a real weird thing.
So is it the Wrecking Crew backing the Beach Boys reunion tour this summer? Maybe it should be.
No, it's not. So it'll be up to the listener when you go to the concert to see what you think of the musicianship.
The name of the book is The Wrecking Crew, The Inside Story of Rock and Roll's Best Kept Secret, The Unknown Studio Musicians Who Recorded the Soundtrack of a Generation, by our guest Kent Hartman. The book is published by St. Martin's. Kent, thank you so much for your time and for writing what I thought was a really fascinating exploration of this great musical scene.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.